And we will move on to the seventh case of this morning, Pamela McKenzie v. John Potter, Postmaster General. Ms. Stix.
Good morning. Sally Stix for the plaintiff appellant, Pamela McKenzie. May it please the court, Mr. Brooks. This is a case where Pamela McKenzie was driven from her job of 11 years due to sexual harassment by a serial harasser while she was employed as an employee of the United States Postal Service. And it's a case where the employer failed to deal properly with her complaint of discrimination.
Of course, in the end, she never quits the job, right? In the end, she's terminated from the job by the Postal Service.
That's way in the future. We believe that that she was actually constructively discharged when she left on her medical leave in July of 1997.
But she was being paid, wasn't she? I mean, maybe disability levels or something, but she was a link between her and the Postal Service at that point.
Correct. She remained employed until we believe the Office of Workers' Comp cut off her work-related disability benefits in, I believe, April of 1998. That's when they found that the post office finally made an offer for her to return to work. But in July of 97, when she actually left the job, we believe that she was constructively discharged at that point.
Do you know of a single constructive discharge case where somebody has stopped going to work and gone on a medical disability instead?
And not.
I'm having trouble conceptualizing that action as constructive discharge, particularly in light of the Souter case. Constructive discharge usually means things are ghastly at work, and so you quit. And instead of being told, well, you've just quit voluntarily, you say, no, in fact, it's the same thing as if I had been fired because things were bad. So people who are under stress or whatever, who for some reason take a medical leave, I'm not familiar with any cases that have put that under the constructive discharge umbrella.
Well, she did have an intent to come back to work, but it just never materialized.
So you don't know of any cases either to...
The closest one was a recent constructive discharge case from the Seventh Circuit from 2006, Patton versus Keystone, where it said a reasonable fact finder could find she should have quit immediately to protect herself. And we believe that that's analogous, even though she was receiving workers' comp benefits at the time that she was off. But the relevant time period, we believe here, is that she complained on June 11th of 1997 to her supervisor, Alan Lipschultz, about Collins's behavior. They had a meeting. Alan Lipschultz convened a meeting of the harasser, Ms. McKenzie, and himself. And during that meeting, which was a face-to-face meeting with the harasser, which we don't believe was an appropriate response to a complaint of sexual harassment, when that meeting was completed, Alan Lipschultz did not even separate the harasser and Ms. McKenzie in terms of their working environment. In a week later, Mr. Lipschultz issued Edgar Collins a letter of warning, which Alan Lipschultz never communicated to Ms. McKenzie. She never knew he was disciplined.
But that's an interesting point. I mean, there are a couple of interesting points you raised. First of all, the Postal Service, in fact, does something vis-a-vis Mr. Collins to remedy the situation. And so the real problem that you're complaining about is Ms. McKenzie doesn't know what they've done. And another issue, I think, is, I mean, it sort of weaves through this, is as time goes on, it really seems to me like a case where even though the Postal Service is doing things such as, you know, whether it was voluntary or partly compelled, Mr. Collins gets moved to a different facility, but she doesn't think that's punitive enough, is this the impression I get from your brief. But that's, as we've written, not really the point of this. The point is to solve the problem.
Correct. The point is to solve the problem. He is not moved into another facility until February of 1998, a full 9 months after she complains.
And she's been off work all this time. Her doctors keep sending in notes saying she can't come back to work.
The post office is attempting to require her to go back to work. They're threatening her with being absent without leave and threatening to terminate her unless she comes back to work.
But I thought their offers, though, at one point there was an offer for a 30-day trial period where she would not, in fact, be in the same place as Mr. Collins.
It's not that she would not be in the same place as Mr. Collins. They said that he would not act as her supervisor. That was not within her, her psychiatrist's restrictions at that point.
Why isn't that, though, a reasonable offer of an accommodation? She doesn't even try it.
In discussing this with her physician, the post office does not attempt to make concessions to what the physicians say she needs to come back to work.
But you're treating this as though it's an ADA case where there's, you know, an interactive process and somebody's got a disability and, you know, people meet each other halfway, hopefully. And whereas this, in fact, as you've brought it, is a sexual harassment case.
Correct. And it's a sexual harassment case where she's on a recognized work-related disability leave. They have recognized that she is off due to sexual harassment, so that is what has to be dealt with in terms of getting her back to work. They don't feel that the offer of returning her under the supervision of this individual satisfies correcting the sexually or the hostile work environment.
Well, not under the supervision. The offer, as you just said, was that she would come back, but Mr. Collins would no longer be her supervisor, right?
Correct, which means that she doesn't work any overtime because he's the supervisor during all of the overtime.
Do we know for a fact, though, that the offer had sort of a little asterisk and you won't get any overtime? I mean, maybe there are other avenues for approving that.
No, they just told her to come back to work and that she would not be under his supervision. And again, that was found not to be satisfactory. Her workers' comp continued after that offer was made, so that workers' comp found that was not a adequate return to work offer.
They're addressing a different issue, though. They're addressing the issue of her disability, whereas the question here is whether the Postal Service was offering her a work environment that Mr. Collins wouldn't disrupt by his misbehavior.
We believe that those arguments actually go to damages because the relevant time period still is back in July of 1997 when she removes herself from the workplace. And I'd like to reserve a couple of moments for a rebuttal.
Mr. Brooks.
May it please the court, counsel. Ms. McKenzie was not constructively discharged. And why? Because after she finally reported Collins' conduct, her work condition improved. And based on the court's comments and questioning, it's got the right focus in this case. The issue is not whether Ms. McKenzie had an injury that continued after she reported Collins' conduct. The issue is, what was her work conditions like at that point, and would a reasonable person in her position be compelled to leave that work environment? And what were the work conditions after she reported the sexual harassment? She said that when she reported it, Lip Schultz seemed appalled. He responded immediately. He told Collins, "What happened here is unacceptable. You can't talk to our workers like that." He then issues a letter of warning for conduct unbecoming a postal supervisor. He says the conduct was intolerable, inexcusable, and in the future would be met with severe discipline, which could include being fired.
Why is there no communication to Ms. McKenzie, if not a copy of the letter, which might be more personal, something that tells her, "We've instituted, you know, step one of our progressive disciplinary process," or something to give her an assurance, since it is psychologically very disturbing to go to a workplace where you're afraid you're going to be subjected to that kind of inappropriate you know, not only conversation, but physical assault. Seems like the least you could do under a properly administered policy is inform her.
I think there's a couple precursors to that answering that question. One is to look at what she asked for when she went to Lipschultz. She wanted Collins to apologize, she wanted the sexual harassment to stop, and she asked Mr. Lipschultz to do what he could about it.
And that's in her deposition, right?
Yes, and that's uncontested. And what happened? Collins apologized, the sexual harassment stopped, and later Lipschultz did issue a letter of warning. He did what he could about it. There was no request that he inform her of what's going to go on later or what discipline is going to issue. I would agree. Perhaps, you know, ideally, he would have let her know. But I also think that it's a red herring in this case with respect to letting her know about the letter of warning. There is no evidence in the record that she had any concern after the meeting of Collins sexually harassing her. None at all. And the letter of warning would go to that issue. Now, she did complain about him glaring the next day, but she does not characterize the glaring as sexual harassment at all.
I think she thinks of it as retaliation for her complaint about harassment, don't you?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, but this is not a retaliation case. And it doesn't go to showing that she was concerned about sexual harassment at all. She said she wasn't. So the sexual harassment ended, and there is no indication that she had a fear of being sexually harassed after that meeting. So what Mr. Lipschultz did was prompt, it was stern, it was effective, and it worked. And to go back now and try and say, well, we're going to rework this, and this is how we want managers to respond, is more along the lines of the court acting as a super personnel department than it is to examining whether or not a tangible employment action occurred, in that sense, whether McKenzie was constructively discharged. Her work environment simply did not get so bad that she was compelled to leave.
To what extent are we talking about an objective versus a subjective problem? Because here's what I'm thinking. You know, there is, of course, a period of time when Mr. Collins is behaving in a completely inappropriate way, and it traumatizes this woman and perhaps traumatized the other person who he had also harassed. And maybe she fell apart more than some people would have, but you have this kind of eggshell plaintiff idea. She, in a sense, has been damaged by his harassing behavior in a way that makes it very hard for her to return to anything that looks at all like the same work environment. He can't be in the building. Maybe she can't even be in that building. Maybe the night shift isn't going to work for her. All sorts of things like that seem to be consequences.
This is not a tort case, however. It's under Title VII, and it's looking at the work environment after she reported the harassment. Was that work environment such that a reasonable person in her position would be compelled to leave it? And that can't be answered affirmatively. She was injured. This conduct was egregious. It was outrageous. It shouldn't happen, and I'm sorry that she had to endure it. But because she was injured does not then lead to a place where she can dictate how the employer responds to the harasser and how the employer manages her work environment in terms of dictating the terms of what her workplace is going to look like and what hours she's going to work, and give her the right to dictate how the employer is going to discipline the harasser. In this case, this manager acted within the bounds of the law. He acted promptly, and he acted in a way that was effective to end the sexual harassment. And that's the goal of Title VII, and that's why the Supreme Court's given Ellerth Fairger as a defense to employers.
Is the evidence, does it show that she was on paid leave of some form or another for the entire 3 years from the time she stopped coming to work and the time that she was terminated?
Here's what happened with that. From the day she reports until her workers' compensation is approved, there is she was on leave, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that she was disciplined or otherwise not granted leave. She has sick leave, and she can use it as she sees fit. Once the workers' compensation claim was granted, She's off work under that program. And there's nothing in the record saying the Postal Service was contesting her right to be off of work during that time. Now, in April or May of 1998, when workers' compensation stops covering her, because it says, hey, you should be back at work at this point, then the Postal Service does issue two warning letters to her saying, look, you're off work, you're absent without leave, you're not using sick leave, you're not on workers' comp anymore. You need to explain yourself. You need to justify your absence. That's when we get into the Postal Service issuing the fitness for duty demands and her doctor saying, no, you know, she's not going to go back to the facility for the examination. It should be at my office. And we get into that dispute. And eventually they issue her a letter of warning, hey, this isn't an explanation. You're not coming in for fitness for duty exams. You're going to get fired. And that's when she grieves it. It goes to this pre-arbitration process. There's a settlement agreement entered. There's an agreement that she come in for two exams under customized circumstances where her doctor can come and it'll be at a different facility. And she doesn't come for either of those. And that's when the Postal Service finally does fire her. So that's the sequence of events.
And what period of time elapses since from the expiration of the workers' comp, which I guess is the second form of leave that she used up during this time period, and the actual termination?
Based on the record, I think workers' compensation ceased in May of 1998. She was fired in March of 2000. So it's quite some time.
2 years.
Yes.
So she's remains employed. She hasn't quit.
She hasn't quit. She hasn't been fired.
But she's not being paid.
She's not being paid, but she's still on the rolls. She's basically grieving a prior notice saying, you know, you haven't explained yourself. You haven't told us why you're not at work. You haven't given us any reason to put you in any a leave status that is recognized. Therefore, you know, you're going to get fired, and that's when she grieves it, and that's when she gets another chance to come back to work and doesn't come in for the exams. I see that time's expiring. Unless there are any further questions from the court, we would ask that you affirm the district court's decision. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brooks. Ms. Sticks, 2 minutes.
I just want to speak a little bit to the Farragher-Ellerth defense. It's an affirmative defense, and it's required to be proved by the Postal Service. And what we believe occurred in this case is that there were a number of times that Ms. McKenzie complained, and in fact there was a prior complaint of sexual harassment that had it been dealt with properly, this may never have happened to Ms. McKenzie. And there is evidence in the record that Mr. Lipschultz did not properly deal with the complaint in the fall of 1996. And in fact, he states that what he did, Mr. Lipschultz, the supervisor, after getting the complaint of sexual harassment from one of the postal workers' unions, is that he spoke with Edgar Collins, and Edgar said he had talked with Sheila Winterpacht, that was the earlier sexual harassment complainer. But he had spoken to her, but no more than being friendly. He may have touched her hand, but never had any intent. He may have made a statement about a black baby, but nothing to imply she was to have one with him. He denied any sexual intent. All Alan Lipschultz did under that circumstance, and he has an affidavit that's in the record, it's Exhibit 3 of his deposition, that he spoke with Supervisor Collins. He never talked to Sheila Winterpacht. Similarly, when Ms. McKenzie complained by letter on June 20th of 1997 that she was dissatisfied with the results of the meeting with her and Edgar Collins, she received no response from Alan Lipschultz as to anything that he had done regarding her complaint. After the June 30th letter, she writes him a letter on July 3rd, and she said, I feel very threatened being in the same building with Edgar Collins. When I reported him to management, he told me that he was very upset with me for jeopardizing his job. I told him that he had done it himself. She never got a response from Mr. Lipschultz regarding that complaint either. She never knew what was being done to take care of the sexual harassment she was facing. We believe that this standard falls below that required with the Farragher-Ellerth defense, and for that reason, a reasonable jury could have found that the USPS complaint system fell below the standard required by that affirmative defense. And we ask that the case be reversed and remanded. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel, and we will take the case under advisement.